Welcome to The Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and with Easter and Passover upon us, today's show will focus on religions and spirituality. It's new ground for us, and we'll begin by previewing several titles very much in the news. Then we'll interview an author whose book offers up meticulous research into an ancient time most of us know very little about. I know I'm ready to spring into the discussion, so let's turn to page one of the book report. Been dreaming of a new kitchen? One right for the way you cook, for optimizing your space and your unique style? Lifestyles Kitchens has a menu of options that work within your budget. Lifestyles Kitchens has been a top design and sales studio for more than 20 years. Their professional designers come to your home, assess your space, your cooking style, and guide you through a wide world of choices. Then they'll design the perfect kitchen or bath with you. Start with cabinets from Woodmode, Brookhaven, Candlelight, DBS, or Neff. Add exquisite counters of granite, engineer stone, and finish with fabulous fixtures. Your dream kitchen doesn't come out of a box or a big box store. And for a truly memorable gift for those special to you, consider a Lifestyle Kitchens gift certificate. Contact them today at lifestyleskitchens.com. That's two S's, lifestyleskitchens.com. Were first discovered in the caves at Qumran in 1947, the Dead Sea Scrolls have aroused more fascination and more controversy than perhaps any other archaeological find. In The Dead Sea Scrolls, a biography, John Collins tells the story of the bitter conflicts that have swirled around the scrolls since their startling discovery, and he sheds light on their true significance for Jewish and Christian history. Collins vividly recounts how a Bedouin shepherd went searching for a lost goat in the Judean desert and found the scrolls. He offers insights into debates about the Essenes who lived around the time of Jesus. Were they an authentic Jewish sect whose beliefs reflect the Judaism of their time? Or were they an isolated, quasi-monastic community living at Qumran? What are the disputes surrounding the scrolls and Christianity? Mark Mosley narrates this fascinating story.
The Dead Sea Scrolls may seem to be an unlikely candidate for inclusion in a series on biographies of books. The scrolls are not, in fact, one book, but a miscellaneous collection of writings retrieved from caves near Qumran at the northwest corner of the Dead Sea between the years 1947 and 1956. In all, fragments of some 900 manuscripts were found. They are written mostly in Hebrew, with some in Aramaic and a small number in Greek. They date from the last 2 centuries BCE and the 1st century CE. The collection is not entirely random, and much, though not all, of it seems to reflect the thought of a Jewish sect, usually identified as the Essenes, around the turn of the era. But the degree of coherence is controversial. While the scrolls are often presumed to be the remnants of the library of a community that lived at the site of Qumran, this view seems increasingly unlikely. It is more likely that they were brought from several sectarian communities and hidden in the caves in the wilderness at the time of the Jewish revolt against Rome, 66 through 70 CE, although some presumably belonged to the community at the site. Unlike the Bible, which is also a collection of writings of diverse origin, the scrolls were never known to constitute a distinct corpus in antiquity. Only after their accidental discovery in the middle of the 20th century CE did the scrolls become a corpus or an entity that might be considered an appropriate subject for a biography. Moreover, the biography of these scrolls is somewhat like that of Rip Van Winkle. While other texts from antiquity influenced the Renaissance or the Reformation, the scrolls just slept. What we have witnessed in the last 65 years or so is not so much a biography as a post-resurrection afterlife, separated from the original environment of the scrolls by an interval of 2 millennia. Nonetheless, the scrolls now exist as a distinct corpus with a life of its own. that life has several dimensions. The scrolls are a scholarly resource studied intensively by an expanding community of scholars and of interest not only to historians of Judaism and Christianity, but also to sociologists of religion and even philosophers. They are also a tourist attraction in Jerusalem as well as in museum exhibitions throughout the Western world. Hundreds of thousands of people have waited patiently to catch a glimpse of selected illegible fragments in dimly lighted display cases and come away feeling that they have touched the past. In October 2011, when the Israel Museum launched a website featuring high-resolution photographs of five important scrolls, the site got more than 1 million hits in the first week. Only a fraction of the people visiting the site are likely to have been scholars who could read the texts from the photographs. The scrolls are fodder for the popular demand for mysteries, exotic, dimly understood lore that is paraded to stimulate curiosity in tabloid newspapers and television shows such as Mysteries of the Bible. They are also sometimes a political symbol, testimony to the antiquity of Jewish roots in the land west of the Jordan, or conversely of modern Israeli expropriation of artifacts that were discovered in territory that was then under Jordanian control and whose ownership remains in dispute. The scrolls have been described as the greatest archaeological discovery of the 20th century. They have certainly been the most controversial. The scrolls attract popular interest and also spark controversy because they are primary documents from ancient Judea, from around the time of Jesus. Prior to the discovery of the scrolls, there were scarcely any Hebrew or Aramaic texts extant from that time and place. Inevitably, there has been an expectation, sometimes fevered, that these texts would shed light on Jesus or the movement of his followers. Several claims in this regard, beginning a few years after the discovery of the scrolls and continuing into the 21st century, have been quite sensational, and it is precisely these claims that have attracted the attention of the wider public. Controversy has been fanned by the fact that many of the fragmentary scrolls remained unpublished for half a century.
We've just heard The Dead Sea Scrolls by John Collins. Clear, Scientology, Hollywood, and the Prison of Belief is an in-depth look into the world of Scientology by Lawrence Wright, Pulitzer Prize-winning author of The Looming Tower. Going Clear is based on more than 200 personal interviews with both current and former Scientologists, both famous and less well-known, and years of archival research. At the book's center, two men whom Wright brings vividly to life, the darkly brilliant science fiction writer L. Ron Hubbard and his successor, David Miscavige, a tough, driven man with the unenviable task of preserving the church after the death of Hubbard. Wright explains Scientology's complicated cosmology and special language, the ways in which the church pursues celebrities like Tom Cruise and John Travolta, and focuses on young idealists who have joined the Sea Org, the church's clergy, signing up with a billion-year contract. He also examines the fundamentals of what makes a religion, and whether Scientology is, in fact, deserving of this constitutional protection. Morton Sellers narrates.
Scientology plays an outsized role in the cast of new religions that have arisen in the 20th century and survived into the 21st. The church won't release official membership figures, but informally it claims 8 million members worldwide, a figure that is based on the number of people who have donated to the church. A recent ad claims that the church welcomes 4.4 million new people every year. And yet, according to a former spokesperson for the church, the International Association of Scientologists, an organization that church members are forcefully encouraged to join, has only about 30,000 members. The largest concentration, about 5,000, is in Los Angeles. A survey of American religious affiliations compiled in the Statistical Abstract of the United States estimates that only 25,000 Americans actually call themselves Scientologists. That's less than half the number identifying themselves as Rastafarians. Despite decades of declining membership and intermittent scandals that might have sunk other faiths, Scientology remains afloat more than a quarter century after the death of its chimerical leader, L. Ron Hubbard. In part, its survival is due to colossal financial resources, about $1 billion in liquid assets, according to knowledgeable former members. Strictly in terms of cash reserves, that figure eclipses the holdings of most major world religions. Scientology's wealth testifies to the avidity of its membership, relentless fundraising, and the legacy of Hubbard's copyrights to the 1,000 books and articles he published. The church also claims about 12 million square feet of property around the world. Hollywood is the center of Scientology's real estate empire, with 26 properties valued at $400 million. The most recent addition to the church's Hollywood portfolio is a television studio on Sunset Boulevard, formerly owned by KCET, acquired in order to open a Scientology broadcasting center. In Clearwater, Florida, where Scientology maintains its spiritual headquarters, the church owns 68 largely tax-exempt parcels of land, valued at $168 million. They include apartment buildings, hotels and motels, warehouses, schools, office buildings, a bank, and tracts of vacant land. The church often acquires landmark buildings near key locations, such as Music Row in Nashville, DuPont Circle in Washington, D.C., and Times Square in New York City. A similar strategy governs the placement of Scientology's holdings in other countries. Typically, these buildings are magnificently restored architectural treasures, lavishly appointed, even if the membership is negligible. The church owns a 500-acre compound in Southern California and a cruise ship, the Freewinds, which is based in the Caribbean. The Church of Spiritual Technology, the branch of Scientology that owns the trademarks and copyrights to all church materials, including Hubbard's immense body of popular fiction, maintains secret bases in several remote locations in at least 3 American states, where the founders' works are stored in titanium canisters in nuclear blast-resistant caverns. One of the vault locations, in Trementina, New Mexico, has an airstrip and 2 giant interlocking circles carved into the desert floor, a landmark for UFOs, some believe, or for Hubbard's reincarnated spirit when he chooses to return. There are really 3 tiers of Scientologists. Public Scientologists constitute the majority of the membership. Many of them have their first exposure to the religion at a subway station or a shopping mall, where they might take a free stress test or a personality inventory called the Oxford Capacity Analysis. There is no actual connection to Oxford University. On those occasions, potential recruits are likely to be told that they have problems that Scientology can resolve, and they are steered to a local church or mission for courses or therapy, which the church terms auditing. That's as far as most new members go, but others begin a lengthy and expensive climb up the church's spiritual ladder.
That was Going Clear, Scientology, Hollywood, and the Prison of Belief by Lawrence Wright. What do you do with a chocolate Jesus? Is the funny yet genuine exploration of the Christian history they don't teach in Sunday school. It finds humor, irony, and occasional insight among the inconsistencies and oddities that sometimes pass for eternal truths. Pitting actual scripture against popular interpretation, Thomas Quinn, an award-winning documentary producer and director, treks through chapter and verse of the New Testament. He explores the saga of medieval beliefs and reveals some of the surprising attitudes of America's founders towards religion. Reviewers liken the book to a history of religion as done by The Daily Show. The author narrates.
Jesus on Economics. The Sermon on the Mount continues, and it has Jesus weighing in on a range of practical issues. Among them is money. One of the more twisted developments of modern Christianity, at least in the United States, is that Jesus has become a hero of free market conservatives. Somehow, this penniless preacher has been morphed into a deregulating laissez-faire investment banker. Personally, I have no problem with the free market, so long as it's understood to be a human contrivance and not holy writ. But capitalism is about material gain. How to make stuff. How to acquire stuff. How to get people to produce more stuff using less stuff so they end up with more stuff. No wonder economists are stuffy. But not Jesus. He didn't care much about stuff.
No one can serve two masters. You cannot serve God and Mammon. Matthew 6:24.
Trinity Broadcasting and a lot of free market fundamentalists seem to have forgotten this. They raise oodles of Mammon, pitching God's 800 number for contributions. Archangels are standing by.
It is easier for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of God. Matthew 19:24.
Not really Rupert Murdoch's motto, is it? The Gospels make a clear point, the same one Plato made centuries earlier. Quote, "It is impossible for an exceptionally good man to be exceptionally rich." Of course, lots of for-profit pastors and evangelical entrepreneurs are willing to give it a try.
"Woe to you who are rich, for you have already received your comfort." Luke 6:24.
I wonder if this makes the Pope nervous. Here's a guy who can fly to some destitute country, preach the virtue of renouncing worldly wealth, then rise up from his throne, gather his satin robes, ride off in his Pope-mobile, and wing his way home on a personal jet to a palatial estate whose interior decorators included Bernini and Michelangelo. When Pope John Paul II passed away in 2005, his funeral was attended by the world media, half the UN, and enough cardinals in flowing robes to make Vatican City look like a gay wedding cake. But when they laid the pontiff to rest, he was placed in a simple pine box because he was a humble man. And we wouldn't want the event to look ostentatious now, would we? It seems clear that if popes lived a little less like Caesar and a little more like Christ, they'd be easier to take seriously about the virtues of salvation over material greed. Of course, a lot of people who vote traditional values don't pay much attention to what Jesus says about money, and for good reason. It's kind of depressing.
"Sell all that you own and distribute the money to the poor, and you will have treasure in heaven." Matthew 19:21.
Sounds like socialism. Think you'll see this in the Republican Party platform anytime soon? You start to see why it's hard to be a genuine Christian in the modern world. It's not just because you can't curse or go bed hopping. It's because you have to live by rules like this.
"Lend, expecting nothing in return, and your reward will be great." Luke 6:35.
And there goes the banking industry. When it comes to money, Jesus is more Dalai Lama than Adam Smith. Nowhere does he extol hard work, private property, personal ambition, wealth creation, efficiency, investment, or saving for the future. Quite the contrary.
"Do not be anxious about your life, what you shall eat or what you shall drink, nor about your body, what you shall put on. Look at the birds of the air. They neither sow nor reap, and yet your heavenly Father feeds them. Consider the lilies of the field, how they grow. They neither toil nor spin." Matthew 6:25.
I had a roommate like this. He neither toiled nor spun. He never did anything. Though the father that fed him wasn't in heaven, he was in St. Louis paying his credit card bills.
That was What Do You Do with a Chocolate Jesus by Thomas R. Quinn. Heaven, A Neurosurgeon's Near-Death Experience and Journey into the Afterlife, is by Dr. Eben Alexander, a Harvard-trained physician. Many people are talking about this title, so I thought the book report would join in the discussion. On November 10, 2008, Dr. Alexander was driven into a coma by a disease so lethal, only 1 in 10 million survive. 7 days later, he awakened with memories of a fantastic odyssey deep into another realm. Memories that included meeting a deceased birth sister he had never known existed. Dr. Alexander deployed all his scientific knowledge to find out whether his mind could have played a trick on him.
In its shutdown state, there was no way it could have functioned at all. That left only one conclusion, that we are conscious in spite of our brains, and that, in fact, consciousness is at the root of all existence. The evidence supporting Dr. Alexander's experience into the heavenly realm transformed him into a believer and has impacted many people's ideas about human consciousness and spirituality. The author narrates,
"My eyes popped open. In the darkness of our bedroom, I focused on the red glow of the bedside clock, 4:30 a.m., an hour before I'd usually wake up for the 70-minute drive from our house in Lynchburg, Virginia, to the Focused Ultrasound Surgery Foundation in Charlottesville, where I worked. My wife, Holly, was still sleeping soundly beside me. After spending almost 20 years in academic neurosurgery in the greater Boston area, I'd moved with Holly and the rest of our family to the Highlands of Virginia 2 years earlier, in 2006. Holly and I met in October 1977, 2 years after both of us had left college. Holly was working toward her master's in fine arts, and I was in medical school. She'd been on a couple of dates with my college roommate, Vic. One day, he brought her by to meet me, probably to show her off. As they were leaving, I told Holly to come back any time, adding that she shouldn't feel obliged to bring Vic. On our first true date, we drove to a party in Charlotte, North Carolina, 2.5 hours each way by car. Holly had laryngitis, so I had to do 99% of the talking both ways. It was easy. We were married in June 1980 at St. Thomas's Episcopal Church in Windsor, North Carolina, and soon after moved into the Royal Oaks Apartments in Durham, where I was a resident in surgery at Duke. Our place was far from royal, and I don't recall spotting any oaks there either. We had very little money, but we were both so busy and so happy to be together that we didn't care. One of our first vacations was a springtime camping tour of North Carolina's beaches. Spring is no-see-um, the biting midge, bug season in the Carolinas, and our tent didn't offer much protection from them. We had plenty of fun just the same. Swimming in the surf one afternoon at Ocracoke, I devised a way to catch the blue shell crabs that were scuttling about at my feet. We took a big batch over to the Pony Island Motel where some friends were staying and cooked them up on a grill. There was plenty to share with everyone. Despite all our cutting corners, it wasn't long till we found ourselves distressingly low on cash. We were staying with our best friends, Bill and Patty Wilson, and on a whim decided to accompany them to a night of bingo. Bill had been going every Thursday of every summer for 10 years, and he had never won. It was Holly's first time playing bingo. Call it beginner's luck or divine intervention, but she won $200, which felt like $5,000 to us. The cash extended our trip and made it much more relaxed. I earned my MD in 1980, just as Holly earned her degree and began a career as an artist and teacher. I performed my first solo brain surgery at Duke in 1981. Our firstborn, Eben IV, was born in 1987 at the Princess Mary Maternity Hospital in Newcastle upon Tyne, in northern England, during my cerebrovascular fellowship, and our younger son, Bond, was born at the Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston in 1998. I loved my 15 years working at Harvard Medical School and Brigham and Women's Hospital. Our family treasured those years in the greater Boston area. But in 2005, Holly and I agreed it was time to move back to the South. We wanted to be closer to our families, and I saw it as an opportunity to have a bit more autonomy than I'd had at Harvard. So in the spring of 2006, we started anew in Lynchburg, in the Highlands of Virginia. It didn't take long for us to settle back into the more relaxed life we'd both enjoyed growing up in the South. For a moment, I just lay there, vaguely trying to zero in on what had awakened me. The previous day, a Sunday, had been sunny, clear, and just a little crisp, classic late autumn Virginia weather. Holly, Bond, who was 10 years old at the time, and I had gone to a barbecue at the home of a neighbor. In the evening, we had spoken by phone to our son, Eben IV, who was then 20, who was a junior at the University of Delaware. The only hitch in the day had been the mild respiratory virus that Holly, Bond, and I were all still dragging around from the previous week. My back had started aching just before bedtime, so I'd taken a quick bath, which seemed to drive the pain into submission.
That was a sampling of Proof of Heaven by Eben Alexander. In Unorthodox, The Scandalous Rejection of My Hasidic Roots, author Deborah Feldman takes listeners on an eye-opening journey into an ultra-Orthodox Jewish culture. Raised in the closed world of Brooklyn's Satmar Hasidim, every aspect of Feldman's life was controlled, down to what she could read and who she could talk to. Married at 17, Deborah suffered from anxiety and was shamed by her inability to please her older husband. But after giving birth to a son at age 19, she realized it was time to tear up her roots and make her own path in life. Reviewers called this work a brave, riveting account of one woman's journey. Rachel Botchin narrates.
I look down at my patent leather shoes tapping impatiently on the sidewalk, and I bite my lip to stop the impulse. I'm grateful to be here. It's not every week that Tati takes me with him. One of my father's many odd jobs is turning the ovens on at Bagel's Kosher Bakery when Shabbos is over. Every Jewish business must cease for the duration of the Shabbos, and the law requires that a Jew be the one to set things in motion again. My father easily qualifies for a job with such simple requirements. The Gentile laborers are already working when he gets there, preparing the dough, shaping it into rolls and loaves. And when my father walks through the vast warehouse, flipping the switches, a humming and whirring sound starts up and builds momentum as we move through the cavernous rooms. This is one of the weeks he takes me with him, and I find it exciting to be surrounded by all this hustle and know that my father is at the center of it, that these people must wait for him to arrive before business can go on as usual. I feel important just knowing that he's important too. The workers nod to him as he passes, smiling even if he's late, and they pat me on the head with powdery gloved hands. By the time my father is done with the last section, the entire factory is pulsating with the sound of mixing machines and conveyor belts. The cement floor vibrates slightly beneath my feet. I watch the trays slide into the ovens and come out the other end with shiny golden rolls, all in a row, as my father makes conversation with the workers while munching on an egg kichel. Bobby loves egg kichel. We always bring her some after our trips to the bakery. In the front room of the warehouse, there are shelves stocked with sealed and packed boxes of various baked goods, ready to be shipped in the morning. And on our way out, we'll take as many as we can carry. There are the famous kosher cupcakes with rainbow sprinkles on top. The loaves of babka, cinnamon and chocolate flavored, the 7-layer cake heavy with margarine, the mini black and white cookies that I only like to eat the chocolate part from. Whatever my father selects on his way out will get dropped off at my grandparents' house later, dumped on the dining room table like bounty, and I'll get to taste it all. What can measure up to this kind of wealth, the abundance of sweets and confections scattered across the damask tablecloth like goods at an auction? Tonight, I'll fall easily into sleep with the taste of frosting still in the crevices of my teeth, crumbs melting into the pockets on either side of my mouth. This is one of the few good moments I share with my father. Often he gives me very little reason to be proud of him. His shirts have yellow spots under the arms, even though Bobby does most of his laundry, and his smile is too wide and silly like a clown's. When he comes to visit me at Bobby's house, he brings me Klein's ice cream bars, dipped in chocolate, and looks at me expectantly as I eat, waiting for my remarks of appreciation. This is being a father, he must think, supplying me with treats. Then he leaves as suddenly as he arrives, off on another one of his errands. People employ him out of pity, I know. They hire him to drive them around, deliver packages, anything they think he's capable of doing without making mistakes. He doesn't understand this. He thinks he's performing a valuable service. My father performs many errands, but the only ones he allows me to participate in are the occasional trips to the bakery and the even rarer ones to the airport. The airport trips are more exciting, but they only happen a couple of times a year. I know it's strange for me to enjoy visiting the airport itself when I know I'll never even get on a plane, but I find it thrilling to stand next to my father as he waits for the person he's supposed to pick up, watching the crowds hurrying to and fro with their luggage squealing loudly behind them, knowing that they are all going somewhere, purposefully.
We've just heard Unorthodox by Deborah Feldman. Emmy Award-winning actor Martin Sheen lends his distinguished voice to Beyond Religion, Ethics for a Whole World by His Holiness the Dalai Lama. The book is a stirring call to move beyond religion for guidance to improve human life on individual, community, and global levels. The Dalai Lama elaborates and deepens his vision for the non-religious way. His Holiness outlines a system of secular ethics that gives tolerant respect to religion, but with the highest level of spiritual and intellectual authority. He makes a claim for what he calls a third way, a universal code of ethics transcending the boundaries of religion, recognizing our common humanity, and advocating a global human community based on understanding and mutual respect.
I am an old man now. I was born in 1935 in a small village in northeastern Tibet. For reasons beyond my control, I have lived most of my adult life as a stateless refugee in India, which has been my second home for over 50 years. I often joke that I am India's longest-staying guest. In common with other people of my age, I have witnessed many of the dramatic events that have shaped the world we live in. Since the late 1960s, I have also traveled a great deal and had the honor to meet people from many different backgrounds, not just presidents and prime ministers, kings and queens, and leaders from all the world's great religious traditions, but also a great number of ordinary people from all walks of life. Looking back over the past decades, I find many reasons to rejoice. Through advances in medical science, deadly diseases have been eradicated. Millions of people have been lifted from poverty and have gained access to modern education and health care. We have a Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and awareness of the importance of such rights has grown tremendously. As a result, the ideals of freedom and democracy have spread around the world, and there is increasing recognition of the oneness of humanity. There is also growing awareness of the importance of a healthy environment. In very many ways, the last half century or so has been one of progress and positive change. At the same time, despite tremendous advances in so many fields, there is still great suffering, and humanity continues to face enormous difficulties and problems. While in the more affluent parts of the world, people enjoy lifestyles of high consumption, there remain countless millions whose basic needs are not met. With the end of the Cold War, the threat of global nuclear destruction has receded, but many continue to endure the sufferings and tragedy of armed conflict. In many areas, too, people are having to deal with environmental problems, and with these, threats to their livelihood and worse. At the same time, many others are struggling to get by in the face of inequality, corruption, and injustice. These problems are not limited to the developing world. In the richer countries, too, there are many difficulties, including widespread social problems, alcoholism, drug abuse, domestic violence, family breakdown. People are worried about their children, about their education, and what the world holds in store for them. Now, too, we have to recognize the possibility that human activity is damaging our planet beyond a point of no return, a threat which creates further fear. And all the pressures of modern life bring with them stress, anxiety, depression, and increasingly loneliness. As a result, everywhere I go, people are complaining. Even I find myself complaining from time to time. It is clear that something is seriously lacking in the way we humans are going about things. But what is it that we lack? The fundamental problem, I believe, is that at every level we are giving too much attention to the external, material aspects of life while neglecting moral ethics and inner values. By inner values, I mean the qualities that we all appreciate in others and toward which we all have a natural instinct, bequeathed by our biological nature as animals that survive and thrive only in an environment of concern, affection, and warm-heartedness, or in a single word, compassion. The essence of compassion is a desire to alleviate the suffering of others and to promote their well-being. This is the spiritual principle from which all other positive inner values emerge. We all appreciate in others the inner qualities of kindness, patience, tolerance, forgiveness, and generosity, and in the same way, we are all averse to displays of greed, malice, hatred, and bigotry. So actively promoting the positive inner qualities of the human heart that arise from our core disposition toward compassion and learning to combat our more destructive propensities will be appreciated by all. And the first beneficiaries of such a strengthening of our inner values will, no doubt, be ourselves.
That was Beyond Religion by His Holiness the Dalai Lama. The Prophet Muhammad by Barnaby Rogerson chronicles the life of a man who established a new religion, Islam, a new state, the First United Arabia, and a new literary language, the classical Arabic of the Quran. A generation after his death, Muhammad would be acknowledged as the founder of a world empire and a new civilization. But he always remained true to himself and retained the humility, courtesy, and humanity he'd learned as an orphan shepherd boy in Central Arabia. Rogerson's elegant biography, narrated by Kelly Hunter, looks directly at the life of the Prophet Muhammad and evokes the Arabian world into which he was born in 570 AD.
Set against even such peripheral mythical figures of Western belief as these, the Prophet Muhammad simply does not feature. To be brutally honest, he has a negative rating. Nor are the associated images particularly good. Try drawing a picture of a man wrapped in a cloak and lost in thought, and introducing it to a classroom of schoolchildren or at a pub quiz night. Ask who it's meant to be and what do you get? Dracula, Darth Vader, or Dark Rider from The Lord of the Rings. If you add a turban, the picture will most probably be taken for that of a wicked vizier or a Barbary pirate. Within Islam, however, he represents almost everything of human value. Muhammad, Prophet of God, the last and greatest of that long line of men, from Adam through to Abraham, Moses and Jesus, who have struggled to bring the word of God to mankind. Even when viewed in an entirely secular perspective, he remains a superhero. He was founder of the Caliphate, one of the greatest empires of the world, creator of classical Arabic, a new literature and world language, founder of a new national identity, the Arab, and creator of Islam, a worldwide culture that is now 1,200 million strong and growing more rapidly than you can count. Only by marrying the best qualities of certain characters from European civilization, a combination, say, of Alexander the Great, Diogenes and Aristotle, or the Emperor Constantine, St. Paul and St. Francis, can you begin to understand the measure of the man. Of course, his historical achievements were mere accidental spin-offs. His only purpose was to forge a new relationship between God and mankind. To those billions of believers who follow in his spiritual path, he is omnipresent within the individual world of imagination, prayer, and petition. He is perceived in many ways. He is the ultimate stern patriarch, that man of men who stands at the forefront of all the saints, heroes, and good rulers from centuries of proud Muslim history. He is the implacable lawgiver, the guide who has clearly pointed out the roads of destiny. This way leads to heaven, this way to hell. He is the loving grandfather, leading the prayers in the mosque while his infant grandson clambers upon his shoulders. He is the sacrificial hero who goes into the testing fire of the spiritual world for the benefit of mankind, shaken to the core of his very being by the terror of being addressed by God through the angels, and all the while persecuted and reviled by his own people. He is the great lover of women. He required no other luxuries, no possessions, so complete was his joy and satisfaction in the company of his wives. He is the wise sage who despised the luxurious trappings of royalty, the halls, guards, courtiers, silks and gold that hitherto had always been associated with power. He's also the savant of the mystics, the guide who has led generations of dervishes, Sufis, poets and lovers of God on their quests. He is the only man to have journeyed to heaven and back. He is the hero of heroes. On a different journey, I took a group of travellers around the courtyard of an ancient mosque, pointing out the architectural details and explaining Islam. As I approached the prayer hall, barred to non-believers by a low wooden screen, the old watchman, in skullcap and blue overalls, stood up and ushered me beyond the screen. He had heard my talk and presumed that I was a Muslim and was now coming in for prayer. The vast, cool, dark hall, its countless marble columns polished by the touch of thousands of worshippers, beckoned. I blushed with pleasure and confusion. I had watched for years as the empty prayer halls of great mosques had filled up with the faithful, watched with the cold eyes of a professional observer, and for the first time I felt like a beggar looking on at a feast.
That was The Prophet Muhammad by Barnaby Rogerson.
Powerful players, ruthless politicians, intrigue and passion. In The Tangled Web, author J.P. Lane takes you on a suspense-packed global trek fraught with paid assassins and deadly plots. Who will be snared in this network of murder and mayhem? Grab The Tangled Web and find out at Kindle stores and iBookstore worldwide. Reviews and more at jp-lane.com. Maggie Anton is the award-winning author of the historical fiction series Rashi's Daughters, and now Rav Hisda's daughter. Maggie was raised in a secular socialist household, and when she reached adulthood, she had little knowledge of her Jewish religion. All that changed when David Parkhurst, who was to become her husband, entered her life, and they both discovered Judaism as adults. She is now a Talmud scholar with expertise in Jewish women's history. Maggie is also a clinical chemist in biochemical genetics. Welcome, Maggie. Thanks so much for stopping by the Book Report.
It is my pleasure to be here.
Introduce us to your novel by telling us about the main characters.
Okay, the main character is Rav Hisda's daughter. Her name is Hizdaduch, which actually means Hizda's daughter in Persian. And we are talking about 3rd century Babylonia. Not everybody's on the top of their know-where-it-is place. So it is modern-day Iraq. We're talking about the land between the Tigris and the Euphrates. And her father, Rav Hisda, is a one of the rabbis who is in the process of creating Talmud. Talmud doesn't exist yet, but this is the beginning of the discussions between the various rabbis that will eventually turn into the Talmud. So she is our heroine. Her father's one of the main characters. And also we have two suitors of hers. And this is actually how I became intrigued by Rav Hisda's daughter to begin with. There's a little section in Talmud. She's about maybe 9 years old. She's in her father's classroom. And depending on the translation, she's either on his lap or she's sitting next to him when he calls up his two best students, Rami Bar Hama, Ava Bar Joseph, and he asks her, "Who do you want to marry?" Now, this, of course, is rather interesting that, first of all, she even has a choice, right, in 3rd century Babylonia. Normally, it might be, here's the guy and the wedding's tomorrow. But she has a choice between two, and the two guys are standing right in front of her. It makes it a little more dramatic. And not only are they standing in front of her, they are in front of the entire classroom of other students. And how does she reply? She says, "Both of them." Yes, very interesting. And the younger of the two guys, arguably the more quick-witted, says, "I'll be the last one." And the Talmud tells us that is indeed what happens. They consider her a prophet because she knows that first she marries the older one, has some kids with him, then she's widowed, then she marries the second one and has another family with him. And when I read this piece of Talmud many, many years ago, I was so intrigued by this story. Like, who is Rav Hisda's daughter? How could she say both of them when asked, "Who do you want to marry?" So I never got her out of my mind.
So she existed. She's a real person. And so is her father.
Absolutely. She is the woman who is mentioned in more different places in the Talmud than any other woman. And her father is one of the heads of what they call a yeshiva, Talmud Academy. He's teaching all these students. And her, the two guys that she eventually marries, both become rather famous rabbis as well in the Talmud. So, yes, they are historical figures.
Talk about the research you did for this novel. You only have to read about five pages and you are, I was so amazed at the depth and breadth of your research. Talk about that.
Well, one thing I got to tell you about my research, for me, writing is the hard work. Research is the fun part. That's why I didn't do Rashi's granddaughters. I had it with the 11th and 12th century. But researching into 3rd century Babylonia, it's a time period that most people do not study. It's not like I'm writing about the Tudors and how could you find anything new. Everything I found was new. And the history of Judaism in and how the Talmud is created in this milieu was very important. Also, that happens around this time is that Emperor Constantine becomes a Christian, and then Rome becomes a Christian empire. That has implications for world history. But the part that really intrigued me, which I didn't even realize I was going to find, was the magic, the sorcery, the when you think of magic. I mean, frankly, the word magic comes from the word magi, who are the Persian priests who are there at this time. And when you think of this time period, you think of like guys on flying carpets and genies in bottles. I mean, the whole mysterious magic world of astrology comes out of this time and place in Babylonia. And as I was trying to find out more actually about women's names, just so I had authentic names for characters, I came across research on a subject called Babylonian incantation bowls, which were more like cups than bowls. They were buried face down under houses and were created between the 4th and 6th century. So the same time the Talmud is being created, these bowls are also coming into existence. They are written in Aramaic, the same language as the Talmud. They're using Hebrew text characters. So we know they're written by Jews. They call upon Jewish angels. They call upon the secret names for God. And their purpose is to protect the inhabitants of these houses under which they're buried from the evil eye, from demons, from illness, from all kinds of nasty stuff to happen to them. And they are essentially spells and incantations for the, we would call white magic, good magic. And they are ubiquitous. They have found thousands of these in Iraq, particularly since 1991 when the Iraq war was and there was a lot of looting and not too much security. Many of these bowls, I mean, some towns under every house, and they've came on the market and scholars have started studying them. And there was some Jewish scholar of the Kabbalah who says, "Nonsense is nonsense, but the study of nonsense, now that is scholarship." So the study of magic and the study of ancient Jewish magic tells us a lot about the lives of the people who commissioned these spells and these amulets and needed their help in their lives.
The Bible and other religious texts call for the death of women who practice sorcery, yet many in the ancient world practiced their skills freely. How did society accept these women?
For the most part, at least the ladies in or the women in Babylonia who were sorceresses were doing a public service. They were healers. Most of the bowls are for protection. and to expel demons who are hurting someone or injuring someone, or to keep the evil eye away, or to, for children, they almost every child wore an amulet so that they wouldn't get sick. So you're going to, I mean, doctor, what they call healers are writing amulets. It's not that they didn't know about bacteria and they didn't have much they could do for healing, but they wrote these bowls, these incantations, and the Talmud talks about this problem with the Bible says you should not allow a sorceress to live. And how do they resolve that problem? They say, oh, the sorcery that the Bible is talking about is the way of the Amorites. You do research, there's no such people as the Amorites. The Amorites were the name of these non-existent people who do the magic the Jews aren't allowed to do. So if Jews are doing it, if Jewish women are doing healing and protection and that kind of magic, then obviously that is not what the Bible forbids. Frankly, Judaism is wide open for you can violate almost any law to save a person's life. And this was part of that, but also the rabbis themselves did magic. Rav Hizda cast spells. They felt that the rabbis on the courts should know enough magic that if a sorceress should show up and try to influence the court proceedings, the rabbis would be able to cast their spells and not let her do that. There was so much information and actual spells to that the rabbis would teach. There were, frankly, more names of demons in the Talmud than there are names of women. And the rabbis regularly encounter them and battle them. And I was really quite astonished at the breadth of sorcery and magic, which all we, you know, as far as we know, wait, you're not supposed to do that. But they're doing it.
And there were love spells, too?
Oh, the love spells, yes. Actually, it's funny. When they found these incantation bowls that were love spells, at first they thought, oh, there's been some horrible fire at this house, and you know, because they're all blackened and burnt. And then when they actually read the incantation, it was, just as this bowl burns, may the heart of so-and-so, son of so-and-so, burn for the daughter of so-and-so. Daughter of so-and-so, and may she come to his bed at night, may they marry. Sometimes they were somewhat risque, saying what they should do in the bed at night. and there's even a few of them that were for two men.
That's a shocker.
Yes. I mean, apparently things weren't that different back in those days as we might imagine.
Are you going to continue on with book two?
Yes, book one is Enchantress, is Apprentice, because I have to start the novel when she's a child. I have to have that scene with the two suitors. So it also includes how does she decide to be a sorceress? Okay, there's people in her family who are, but she still has to make a decision. How does she train? Is there like Hogwarts in Babylonia? And that the book one is essentially with her first husband and her starting on the path to become an enchantress. And then in book two, she makes the decision she is really going to commit herself to this, despite the fact that once, as you become more powerful, you will have more enemies. You will have more other sorceresses who are threatened by your power. And she will marry the second husband in book two. So the adventure continues in the second one.
All right. Well, this is fascinating stuff. I loved reading your book, and I'm looking forward to the next one. Rav Hizda's Daughter, thanks so much for joining us today.
It was my pleasure to be here, and I thank you very much for inviting me.
From Elie Wiesel, winner of the Nobel Peace Prize, comes Rashi, an introduction to the towering figure of Rabbi Shlomo Yitzchaki, the great biblical and Talmudic commentator of the Middle Ages. Wiesel brilliantly evokes the world of medieval European Jewry, a world of profound scholars and closed communities ravaged by outbursts of anti-Semitism and decimated by the Crusades. Rashi's phase-by-phase explanation of the oral law has been included in every printing of the Talmud since the 15th century. His perspective, encompassing both the mundane and the profound, is timeless.
Wiesel, a descendant of Rashi, proves an incomparable guide who enables us to appreciate both the lucidity of Rashi's writings and the milieu in which they were formed. Walter Dixon narrates.
In spite of distances, there were deep contacts between the communities. Their right to intervene in one another's affairs was recognized by the competent rabbinical authorities. After all, didn't they share a common destiny? As for me today, I am looking for the traces of a man whose learning still influences my life, as it does the lives of all those who have a thirst for study. Houses, large and small. Stores, gardens. The man I am looking for must have walked here, dreamed here, shed tears here over the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem, comforted broken hearts, counseled those who had gone astray, taught them to overcome fear and hope for the arrival of the Messiah. I remember, as a child, his cursive script frightened me. More than that of the Bible, it suggested a world that was doubtless complex and probably mysterious, where only adults had the right and competence to enter. Later, with the years, in the cheder or yeshiva, before the candles on the table, every time someone asked, "What does Rashi say?" I rushed to look at his countless commentaries. Whenever I couldn't grasp the meaning of a word, it was he, the teacher of my teachers, who rescued me. An intimate relationship from child to elderly man, person to person. He said to me, as if confidentially, "Look, my child, fear nothing. Everything must be grasped and conveyed with simplicity. Strange words stand in the way like obstacles? Start all over again with me. It happened to me, too. I started all over again. You just have to break through the shell of a word, a sentence, an expression. Everything is inside them. Everything is waiting for you." Thanks to his life, his erudition, his work, his generosity, he remains the spring from which we all drink. Without him, my thirst would never have been quenched. Without him, I would have gone astray more than once in the gigantic labyrinth that is the Babylonian Talmud. Yet he doesn't try to impress us with his learning, his vast religious and secular culture, his originality, or even his inventive mind. He confines himself to quoting the ancients or his precursors, sometimes his peers, and even his own disciples. Rashi, or the celebration of commentary? Better yet, Rashi, or the celebration of memory and of fraternity, too. The danger lies in oblivion. Were I to forget where I come from, my life would become barren and sterile. Were I to forget whom I am the descendant of, I would be doomed to despair. I loved him. I couldn't make headway without him. Of course, I explored other approaches, other commentaries, those of Abravanel, Sforno, Radak, or HaChaim, Ibn Ezra. But Rashi's are unique, different, indispensable. He radiates warmth and friendship and simplicity. He is great because he remains faithful to the text and to its literal meaning. He never uses his learning to make things complicated, but to simplify. He never flaunts his erudition to impress students with the originality of his reasoning. Reconciling two words, two sentences, two verses is enough for him. To those who are timid, he seems to be saying, "Don't be afraid. I am here by your side." Sometimes in my small town, it seemed to me that Rashi had been sent to Earth primarily to help Jewish children overcome loneliness and fear.
That was Rashi by Elie Wiesel. Readers, so much to contemplate, so many incredible minds at work. I hope you've enjoyed this exploration. Whether nonfiction or fiction is your preference, check my website, bookreportradio.com, for hundreds of thought-provoking titles. As spring begins to bloom around us, I'm wishing you and your families very happy holidays, and hoping we'll meet again in a week for the next edition of The Book Report.